Chapter 10. But unfortunately you do not solve the class problem by making friends with tramps. At most you get rid of some of your own class prejudice by doing so. Tramps, beggars, criminals and social outcasts generally are very exceptional beings and no more typical of the working class as a whole than, say, the literary intelligentsia are typical of the bourgeoisie. It is quite easy to be on terms of intimacy with a foreign intellectual, but it is not at all easy to be on terms of intimacy with an ordinary respectable foreigner of the middle class. How many Englishmen have seen the inside of an ordinary French bourgeois family, for instance? Probably it would be quite impossible to do so, short of marrying into it. And it is rather similar with the English working class. Nothing is easier than to be bosom pals with a pickpocket, if you know where to look for him, but it is very difficult to be bosom pals with a bricklayer. But why is it so easy to be on equal terms with social outcasts? People have often said to me, "Surely when you are with the tramps they don't really accept you as one of themselves. Surely they notice that you are different, notice the difference of accent, etc. etc." As a matter of fact, a fair proportion of tramps, well over a quarter I should say, notice nothing of the kind. To begin with, many people have no ear for accent and judge you entirely by your clothes. I was often struck by this fact when I was begging at back doors. Some people were obviously surprised by my educated accent, others completely failed to notice it. I was dirty and ragged and that was all they saw. Again, tramps come from all parts of the British Isles and the variation in English accents is enormous. A tramp is used to hearing all kinds of accents among his mates, some of them so strange to him that he can hardly understand them, and a man from, say, Cardiff or Durham or Dublin does not necessarily know which of the South English accents is an educated one. In any case, men with educated accents, though rare among tramps, are not unknown. But even when tramps are aware that you are of different origin from themselves, it does not necessarily alter their attitude. From their point of view, all that matters is that you, like themselves, are on the bum. And in that world it is not done to ask too many questions. You can tell people the history of your life if you choose, and most tramps do so on the smallest provocation, but you are under no compulsion to tell it and whatever story you tell will be accepted without question. Even a bishop could be at home among tramps if he wore the right clothes, and even if they knew he was a bishop it might not make any difference, provided that they also knew or believed that he was genuinely destitute. Once you are in that world and seemingly of it, it hardly matters what you have been in the past. It is a sort of world within a world where everyone is equal, a small squalid democracy, perhaps the nearest thing to a democracy that exists in England. But when you come to the normal working class, the position is totally different. To begin with, there is no short cut into their midst. You can become a tramp simply by putting on the right clothes and going to the nearest casual ward, but you can't become a navvy or a coal miner. You couldn't get a job as a navvy or a coal miner even if you were equal to the work. Via socialist politics you can get in touch with the working class intelligentsia, but they are hardly more typical than tramps or burglars. For the rest you can only mingle with the working class by staying in their houses as a lodger, which always has a dangerous resemblance to slumming. For some months I lived entirely in coal miners' houses. I ate my meals with the family, I washed at the kitchen sink, I shared bedrooms with miners, drank beer with them, played darts with them, talked to them by the hour together. But though I was among them, and I hope and trust they did not find me a nuisance, I was not one of them, and they knew it even better than I did. However much you like them, however interesting you find their conversation, there is always that accursed itch of class difference, like the pea under the princess's mattress. It is not a question of dislike or distaste, only of difference, but it is enough to make real intimacy impossible. Even with miners who described themselves as communists, I found that it needed tactful maneuverings to prevent them from calling me sir, and all of them, except in moments of great animation, softened their northern accents for my benefit. I liked them and hoped they liked me, but I went among them as a foreigner, and both of us were aware of it. Whichever way you turn, this curse of class difference confronts you like a wall of stone. Or rather, it is not so much like a stone wall as the plate glass pane of an aquarium, It is so easy to pretend that it isn't there, and so impossible to get through it. Unfortunately, it is nowadays the fashion to pretend that the glass is penetrable. Of course, everyone knows that class prejudice exists, but at the same time everyone claims that he, in some mysterious way, is exempt from it. Snobbishness is one of those vices which we can discern in everyone else but never in ourselves. Not only the croyant et pratiquant socialist, but every intellectual, takes it as a matter of course that he at least is outside the class racket. He, unlike his neighbors, can see through the absurdity of wealth, ranks, tides, etc. etc. "I'm not a snob" is nowadays a kind of universal credo. Who is there who has not jeered at the House of Lords, the military caste, the royal family, the public schools, the Hunton and Shooton people, the old ladies in Cheltenham boarding houses? The horrors of county society and the social hierarchy generally. To do so has become an automatic gesture. You notice this particularly in novels. Every novelist of serious pretensions adopts an ironic attitude towards his upper-class characters. Indeed, when a novelist has to put a definitely upper-class person, a duke or a baronet or whatnot, into one of his stories, he guys him more or less instinctively. There is an important subsidiary cause of this in the poverty of the modern upper-class dialect. The speech of educated people is now so lifeless and characterless that a novelist can do nothing with it. By far the easiest way of making it amusing is to burlesque it, which means pretending that every upper-class person is an ineffectual ass. The trick is imitated from novelist to novelist, and in the end becomes almost a reflex action. And yet all the while, at the bottom of his heart, everyone knows that this is humbug. We all rail against class distinctions, but very few people seriously want to abolish them. Here you come upon the important fact that every revolutionary opinion draws part of its strength from a secret conviction that nothing can be changed. If you want a good illustration of this, it is worth studying the novels and plays of John Galsworthy, keeping one eye on their chronology. Galsworthy is a very fine specimen of the thin-skinned, tear-in-the-eye, pre-war humanitarian. He starts out with a morbid pity complex which extends even to thinking that every married woman is an angel chained to a satyr. He is in a perpetual quiver of indignation over the sufferings of overworked clerks, of underpaid farm hands, of fallen women, of criminals, of prostitutes, of animals. The world, as he sees it in his earlier books, The Man of Property, Justice, etc., is divided into oppressors and oppressed, with the oppressors sitting on top like some monstrous stone idol which all the dynamite in the world cannot overthrow. But is it so certain that he really wants it overthrown? On the contrary, in his fight against an immovable tyranny, he is upheld by the consciousness that it is immovable. When things happen unexpectedly and the world order which he has known begins to crumble, he feels somewhat differently about it. So, having set out to be the champion of the underdog against tyranny and injustice, he ends by advocating, vide the silver spoon, that the English working class, to cure their economic ills, shall be deported to the colonies like batches of cattle. If he had lived 10 years longer, he would quite probably have arrived at some genteel version of fascism. This is the inevitable fate of the sentimentalist. All his opinions change into their opposites at the first brush of reality. The same streak of soggy half-baked insincerity runs through all advanced opinion. Take the question of imperialism, for instance. Every left-wing intellectual is, as a matter of course, an anti-imperialist. He claims to be outside the empire racket as automatically and self-righteously as he claims to be outside the class racket. Even the right-wing intellectual, who is not definitely in revolt against British imperialism, pretends to regard it with a sort of amused detachment. It is so easy to be witty about the British Empire. The White Man's Burden and Rule, Britannia, and Kipling's novels and Anglo-Indian Boers, who could even mention such things without a snigger? And is there any cultured person who has not at least once in his life made a joke about that old Indian Havildar who said that if the British left India there would not be a rupee or a virgin left between Peshawar and Delhi, or wherever it was? That is the attitude of the typical left-winger towards imperialism, and a thoroughly flabby, boneless attitude it is. For in the last resort, the only important question is, Do you want the British Empire to hold together or do you want it to disintegrate? And at the bottom of his heart, no Englishman, least of all the kind of person who is witty about Anglo-Indian colonels, does want it to disintegrate. For, apart from any other consideration, the high standard of life we enjoy in England depends upon our keeping a tight hold on the empire, particularly the tropical portions of it such as India and Africa. Under the capitalist system, in order that England may live in comparative comfort, 100 million Indians must live on the verge of starvation, an evil state of affairs. But you acquiesce in it every time you step into a taxi or eat a plate of strawberries and cream. The alternative is to throw the empire overboard and reduce England to a cold and unimportant little island where we should all have to work very hard and live mainly on herrings and potatoes. That is the very last thing that any left-winger wants. Yet the left-winger continues to feel that he has no moral responsibility for imperialism. He is perfectly ready to accept the products of empire and to save his soul by sneering at the people who hold the empire together. It is at this point that one begins to grasp the unreality of most people's attitude towards the class question. So long as it is merely a question of ameliorating the workers' lot, every decent person is agreed. Take a coal miner, for example. Everyone, barring fools and scoundrels, would like to see the miner better off. If, for instance, the miner could ride to the coal face in a comfortable trolley instead of crawling on his hands and knees, if he could work a 3-hour shift instead of 7.5 hours. If he could live in a decent house with 5 bedrooms and a bathroom and have £10 a week wages, splendid. Moreover, anyone who uses his brain knows perfectly well that this is within the range of possibility. The world, potentially at least, is immensely rich. Develop it as it might be developed, and we could all live like princes, supposing that we wanted to. And to a very superficial glance, the social side of the question looks equally simple. In a sense, it is true that almost everyone would like to see class distinctions abolished. Obviously, this perpetual uneasiness between man and man, from which we suffer in modern England, is a curse and a nuisance. Hence the temptation to believe that it can be shouted out of existence with a few scoutmasterish bellows of goodwill. Stop calling me, sir, you chaps. Surely we're all men. Let's pal up and get our shoulders to the wheel and remember that we're all equal, and what the devil does it matter if I know what kind of ties to wear and you don't. And I drink my soup comparatively quietly and you drink yours with the noise of water going down a waste pipe, and so on and so on and so on. All of it the most pernicious rubbish, but quite alluring when it is suitably expressed. But unfortunately you get no further by merely wishing class distinctions away. More exactly, it is necessary to wish them away, but your wish has no efficacy unless you grasp what it involves. The fact that has got to be faced is that to abolish class distinctions means abolishing a part of yourself. Here am I, a typical member of the middle class. It is easy for me to say that I want to get rid of class distinctions, but nearly everything I think and do is a result of class distinctions. All my notions, notions of good and evil, of pleasant and unpleasant, of funny and serious, of ugly and beautiful, are essentially middle-class notions. My taste in books and food and clothes, my sense of honor, my table manners, my turns of speech, my accent, even the characteristic movements of my body, are the products of a special kind of upbringing and a special niche about halfway up the social hierarchy. When I grasp this, I grasp that it is no use clapping a proletarian on the back and telling him that he is as good a man as I am. If I want real contact with him, I have got to make an effort for which very likely I am unprepared. For to get outside the class racket, I have got to suppress not merely my private snobbishness, but most of my other tastes and prejudices as well. I have got to alter myself so completely that at the end I should hardly be recognizable as the same person. What is involved is not merely the amelioration of working class conditions, nor an avoidance of the more stupid forms of snobbery, but a complete abandonment of the upper class and middle class attitude to life. And whether I say yes or no probably depends upon the extent to which I grasp what is demanded of me. Many people, however, imagine that they can abolish class distinctions without making any uncomfortable change in their own habits and ideology. Hence the eager class-breaking activities which one can see in progress on all sides. Everywhere there are people of good will who quite honestly believe that they are working for the overthrow of class distinctions. The middle-class socialist enthuses over the proletariat and runs summer schools where the proletarian and the repentant bourgeois are supposed to fall upon one another's necks and be brothers forever. And the bourgeois visitors come away saying how wonderful and inspiring it has all been, the proletarian ones come away saying something different. And then there is the outer suburban creeping Jesus, a hangover from the William Morris period, but still surprisingly common, who goes about saying, "Why must we level down? Why not level up?" And proposes to level the working class up, to his own standard, by means of hygiene, fruit juice, birth control, poetry, etc. Even the Duke of York, now King George VI, runs a yearly camp where public schoolboys and boys from the slums are supposed to mix on exactly equal terms, and do mix for the time being. Rather like the animals in one of those happy family cages where a dog, a cat, two ferrets, a rabbit and three canaries preserve an armed truce while the showman's eye is on them. All such deliberate, conscious efforts at class-breaking are, I am convinced, a very serious mistake. Sometimes they are merely futile, but where they do show a definite result it is usually to intensify class prejudice. This, if you come to think of it, is only what might be expected. You have forced the pace and set up an uneasy, unnatural equality between class and class. The resultant friction brings to the surface all kinds of feelings that might otherwise have remained buried, perhaps forever. As I said apropos of Galsworthy, the opinions of the sentimentalist change into their opposites at the first touch of reality. Scratch the average pacifist and you find a jingo. The middle-class ILPer and the bearded fruit juice drinker are all for a classless society so long as they see the proletariat through the wrong end of the telescope. Force them into any real contact with a proletarian, let them get into a fight with a drunken fish porter on Saturday night, for instance, and they are capable of swinging back to the most ordinary middle-class snobbishness. Most middle-class socialists, however, are very unlikely to get into fights with drunken fish porters. When they do make a genuine contact with the working class, it is usually with the working class intelligentsia. But the working class intelligentsia is sharply divisible into two different types. There is the type who remains working class, who goes on working as a mechanic or a dock laborer or whatever it may be and does not bother to change his working class accent and habits. But who improves his mind in his spare time and works for the ILP or the Communist Party. And there is the type who does alter his way of life, at least externally, and who by means of state scholarship succeeds in climbing into the middle class. The first is one of the finest types of man we have. I can think of some I have met whom not even the most hidebound Tory could help liking and admiring. The other type, with exceptions, D. H. Lawrence, for example, is less admirable. To begin with, it is a pity, though it is a natural result of the scholarship system, that the proletariat should tend to interpenetrate the middle class via the literary intelligentsia. For it is not easy to crash your way into the literary intelligentsia if you happen to be a decent human being. The modern English literary world, at any rate the highbrow section of it, is a sort of poisonous jungle where only weeds can flourish. It is just possible to be a literary gent and to keep your decency if you are a definitely popular writer, a writer of detective stories, for instance. But to be a highbrow, with a footing in the snootier magazines, means delivering yourself over to horrible campaigns of wire-pulling and backstairs crawling. In the highbrow world you get on, if you get on, at all, not so much by your literary ability as by being the life and soul of cocktail parties and kissing the bums of verminous little lions. This, then, is the world that most readily opens its doors to the proletarian who is climbing out of his own class. The clever boy of a working-class family, the sort of boy who wins scholarships and is obviously not fitted for a life of manual labor, may find other ways of rising into the class above, a slightly different type, for instance. Rises via Labor Party politics, but the literary way is by far the most usual. Literary London now teems with young men who are of proletarian origin and have been educated by means of scholarships. Many of them are very disagreeable people, quite unrepresentative of their class, and it is most unfortunate that when a person of bourgeois origin does succeed in meeting a proletarian face to face on equal terms, this is the type he most commonly meets. For the result is to drive the bourgeois, who has idealized the proletariat so long as he knew nothing about them, back into frenzies of snobbishness. The process is sometimes very comic to watch, if you happen to be watching it from the outside. The poor well-meaning bourgeois, eager to embrace his proletarian brother, leaps forward with open arms. And only a little while later he is in retreat, minus a borrowed £5 and exclaiming dolefully, "But, dash it, the fellow's not a gentleman." The thing that disconcerts the bourgeois in a contact of this kind is to find certain of his own professions being taken seriously. I have pointed out that the left-wing opinions of the average intellectual are mainly spurious. From pure imitativeness he jeers at things which in fact he believes in. As one example out of many, take the public school code of honor, with its team spirit and "don't hit a man when he's down," and all the rest of that familiar bunkum. Who has not laughed at it? Who, calling himself an intellectual, would dare not to laugh at it? But it is a bit different when you meet somebody who laughs at it from the outside. Just as we spend our lives in abusing England but grow very angry when we hear a foreigner saying exactly the same things. No one has been more amusing about the public schools than Beachcomber, of the Express. He laughs, quite rightly, at the ridiculous code which makes cheating at cards the worst of all sins. But would Beachcomber like it if one of his own friends was caught cheating at cards? I doubt it. It is only when you meet someone of a different culture from yourself that you begin to realize what your own beliefs really are. If you are a bourgeois intellectual, you too readily imagine that you have somehow become unbourgeois because you find it easy to laugh at patriotism and the C of E and the old school tie and Colonel Blimp and all the rest of it. But from the point of view of the proletarian intellectual, who at least by origin is genuinely outside the bourgeois culture, your resemblances to Colonel Blimp may be more important than your differences. Very likely he looks upon you and Colonel Blimp as practically equivalent persons, and in a way he is right, though neither you nor Colonel Blimp would admit it. So that the meeting of proletarian and bourgeois, when they do succeed in meeting, is not always the embrace of long-lost brothers, too often it is the clash of alien cultures which can only meet in war. I have been looking at this from the point of view of the bourgeois who finds his secret beliefs challenged and is driven back to a frightened conservatism. But one has also got to consider the antagonism that is aroused in the proletarian intellectual. By his own efforts and sometimes with frightful agonies he has struggled out of his own class into another where he expects to find a wider freedom and a greater intellectual refinement. And all he finds, very often, is a sort of hollowness, a deadness, a lack of any warm human feeling, of any real life whatever. Sometimes the bourgeoisie seem to him just dummies with money and water in their veins instead of blood. This at any rate is what he says, and almost any young highbrow of proletarian origin will spin you this line of talk. Hence the proletarian cant from which we now suffer. Everyone knows, or ought to know by this time, how it runs. The bourgeoisie are dead, a favorite word of abuse nowadays and very effective because meaningless, bourgeois culture is bankrupt, bourgeois values are despicable. And so on and so forth. If you want examples, see any number of the Left Review or any of the younger communist writers such as Alec Brown, Philip Henderson, etc. The sincerity of much of this is suspect, but D.H. Lawrence, who was sincere, whatever else he may not have been, expresses the same thought over and over again. It is curious how he harps upon that idea that the English bourgeoisie are all dead, or at least gelded. Mellers, the gamekeeper in Lady Chatterley's Lover, really Lawrence himself, has had the opportunity to get out of his own class and does not particularly want to return to it, because English working people have various disagreeable habits. On the other hand, the bourgeoisie, with whom he has also mixed to some extent, seem to him half dead, a race of eunuchs. Lady Chatterley's husband, symbolically, is impotent in the actual physical sense. And then there is the poem about the young man, once again Lawrence himself, who got up to the top of the tree, but came down saying, "Oh, you've got to be like a monkey. If you climb up the tree, you've no more use for the solid earth. And the lad you used to be, you sit in the boughs and gibber with superiority. They all gibber and gibber and chatter, and never a word they say comes really out of their guts, lad. They make it up halfway. I tell you, something's been done to them, to the pullets up above. There's not a cockbird among them," etc., etc. You could hardly have it in plainer terms than that. Possibly by the people at the top of the tree, Lawrence only means the real bourgeoisie, those in the £2,000 a year class and over, but I doubt it. More probably he means everyone who is more or less within the bourgeois culture, everyone who was brought up with a mincing accent and in a house where there were one or two servants. And at this point you realize the danger of the proletarian can't realize, I mean, the terrible antagonism that it is capable of arousing. For when you come to such an accusation as this, you are up against a blank wall. Lawrence tells me that because I have been to a public school I am a eunuch. Well, what about it? I can produce medical evidence to the contrary, but what good will that do? Lawrence's condemnation remains. If you tell me I am a scoundrel, I may mend my ways, but if you tell me I am a eunuch, you are tempting me to hit back in any way that seems feasible. If you want to make an enemy of a man, tell him that his ills are incurable. This, then, is the net result of most meetings between proletarian and bourgeois. They lay bare a real antagonism which is intensified by the proletarian cant, itself the product of forced contacts between class and class. The only sensible procedure is to go slow and not force the pace. If you secretly think of yourself as a gentleman and as such the superior of the greengrocer's errand boy, it is far better to say so than to tell lies about it. Ultimately you have got to drop your snobbishness, but it is fatal to pretend to drop it before you are really ready to do so. Meanwhile one can observe on every side that dreary phenomenon, the middle-class person who is an ardent socialist at 25 and a sniffish conservative at 35. In a way his recoil is natural enough, at any rate, one can see how his thoughts run. Perhaps a classless society doesn't mean a beatific state of affairs in which we shall all go on behaving exactly as before, except that there will be no class hatred and no snobbishness. Perhaps it means a bleak world in which all our ideals, our codes, our tastes, our ideology, in fact, will have no meaning. Perhaps this class-breaking business isn't so simple as it looked. On the contrary, it is a wild ride into the darkness, and it may be that at the end of it the smile will be on the face of the tiger. With loving those slightly patronizing smiles we set out to greet our proletarian brothers, and behold, our proletarian brothers, in so far as we understand them, are not asking for our greetings, they are asking us to commit suicide. When the bourgeois sees it in that form he takes to flight, and if his flight is rapid enough it may carry him to fascism.